Okay, so maybe let's start with Ajahn Brahmali's group that was in the other room. So who is the... okay.
So we have... So we have 10 brief answers. Unsure? No. Bodily craving is neutral. Okay. We have 10 brief answers. Unsure? No. Bodily craving is neutral. Wholesome craving is good, but not over the top. Good desires, but not good cravings. And we have to balance craving. Say, good, wholesome craving is good until... that was mine, I didn't write the summary for that. Let's skip that. Craving is always negative. Craving is relative. Gradual moving away from craving. Good craving exists, such as immersion in the Dhamma. Craving is no good. Deep down, we all know what is good and bad. Thank you.
So was there a general consensus on whether it's good or not good? Okay. All right. That's another day's topic. Thank you. All right. We'll have this group, Cecilia.
Okay. So we criticize the question. Does good, does good craving exist? I think that we had to... look at the questions asked, does good craving exist, rather than is craving good? So craving is not good, obviously, for the purposes of dependent origination, because the more, if you have craving, you'll be reborn again. That's the conclusion. However, we also concluded that good craving does exist in the sense of aspirations. We have aspirations, craving to reach enlightenment, desire for different craving, depending on your mind. You know, it's a gradual process. Lay people have craving, but it's more for aspirations. But craving, in terms of dependent origination, is not good.
Thank you. Looks like we've got a lot of highly intellectual people in the room. So that's why we have to like rephrase and then maybe interpret in a different way. So the answers are coming out in different forms. Okay, this group over here, Ben. So Ben, I think it's the first day for her attending the workshop. So she was doing the writing, not realizing that she has to do the debrief at the end.
our group reached a conclusion that if the craving leads to more wholesome quality, then it's good craving. It's something that you need to pursue, whereas if it leads to the unwholesome qualities, then something you need to drop. And we also use other words for cravings, such as desire and aspiration for the wholesome qualities. And then craving that leads to suffering is negative.
Thanks, Ben. All right, we'll have the last group with a number of the nuns there and Venerable Sunia. Can it take the longest time?
Ben, yeah,
you're reading it.
We have so many points.
Oh, wow.
Let me see.
No wonder you guys didn't want to come back. If I had not gone to call you guys, but you'd still be chatting away.
Yeah, we got caught up in semantics a lot because we couldn't agree on the definition of craving versus desire versus longing versus wishing, etc. And we had many of the same points that were brought up here. Like if it leads to good things, if it leads to wholesome results, then whatever craving or desire can be good. But in another sense, if you look at craving according to the Buddha's definition, then it always comes from ignorance and then it's always bad. So it sort of depends on how you use the word, I suppose. Would that sort of sum up what we said? I think so. There's a lot of other points, but...
Were there any controversial questions? People hanging on, like holding on to something they want to let go.
Yeah, well.
Believing that.
Well, I'm not sure if it's controversial, but I said craving can be good because this is just my point. I'm not really speaking for any other. But Because when I was a layperson, I lived a very busy life, you know, lots of music and friends and partying and whatever not. And I just had the craving to be more peaceful. It wasn't really just a desire. It was really like quite strong sometimes. It almost like, yeah, really a craving to find more peace in my life and to have some sense of direction, etc. And if I wouldn't never have had that kind of craving, I wouldn't be here as a monk now. I would just still be doing all sorts of silly whatever I would have done as a layperson, all that silly thing. So then craving, it led to good things in the end. So yeah, at different levels it can be good, so maybe in that sense.
Hurrah! I just want to add to what Ben Vasudhara is saying, is that craving is part of what it is to be a human being. You can't just wish it away. You can't just kind of go like that and craving is gone. So craving is a gradual... Can you hear me okay? Yeah. Craving is a gradual movement away from craving. Yeah, you start with the coarser cravings and you move away from it. And certain cravings on the way, like the craving to be peaceful, or like the Buddha says in the suttas, the desire, oh, when is my mind going to be free from the defilements? Yeah, this is actually specifically said to be a good desire in the suttas, the kind of desire that leads to the end of all desires. And that is considered a wholesome desire at that point. Of course, later on you have to give it up and then it's no longer really required. But in the meantime, you have to move gradually away from things. I think this is, I think we all can agree that craving is generally bad, but because we can't get rid of it just like that, what we have to do is we have to move from more coarser cravings to more refined cravings. We have to abandon craving gradually. If you try to abandon everything in one go, you're just going to suffer. It's going to be impossible. You can't do it. So you abandon it gradually. As you abandon it gradually, your mind develops. Yeah, you find more inner peace, inner joy that allows you to abandon craving more. Yeah, you find even more joy and peace within. And it's this gradual movement which is the right one. If you suffer too much because you try to abandon things too fast, probably you're going to slow down your progress because you're making it too unbearable to practice the Buddhist path. So be wise about what you're doing. Don't try to be an arahant straight away. Yeah, if you try to be an arahant straight away, you're not going to be an arahant. Yeah, that's the problem. Anyway, that's the how I would summarize it. Yeah.
Ajahn, I think we still have 2 more minutes before the 1 o'clock. That's when the next session starts. But anyway, in my group, I think there was an interesting question because we were also kind of like looking at the whole explanation and how you interpret each of the words. So I think it was Ananda who kind of like mentioned that. So the Pali word for craving is tanha, right? So is there such a Pali word that says good tanha? You know, whereas when we look at craving, we're like, yeah, maybe it can be good, it can be bad, and then maybe sometimes it should be wholesome, but maybe if it's wholesome, you don't call it craving. So if you just use the Pali term tanha, is that just the negative?
Tanha is just negative. In the suttas, it's just negative. It's used exclusively in the negative sense. And it's used of the three kinds of craving. Yeah, craving for sensual pleasures, craving for existence, and craving for annihilation. That's how it's basically used. Independent origination, for some reason, it's defined slightly differently as craving for the 6 objects of the senses. But it tends to be bad in the suttas. But even though that is true, it is bad. Yeah, sometimes you have to do a lesser bad before you can eliminate bad completely. You can't go from really bad to no bad. You have to go really bad, little bit less bad, little bit less bad, and then tiny, tiny, mighty bad, and then you give up bad, yeah? So you have to know the sequence of things. Otherwise, it's too hard. But yes, that's basically true, I would say.
So is it also like the sutta that you were talking about when Buddha said there's 2 kinds of thoughts? So maybe we should have, there's 2 kinds of craving. So there's a good craving is one least and a bad craving. And we try to eliminate more of the bad cravings.
I think you're going to have to write your own commentary on that one, Leigh. I don't think it exists so far. It's a new idea.
Does good craving exist, yes or no?
Who thinks yes?
Okay, let's do a vote then.
Who thinks no?
That's pretty equal. Yeah,
pretty equal. Okay,
come on, I'm quite sure you have good cravings.
Who says don't know? Yeah, the honest ones. Okay. What's a good question?
Well, I think unless anybody has anything else to add on that topic, we can move on with the next factor of dependent origination that comes after craving. And who knows what that is? Arjun Ramali knows. You'll pass the quiz at the end. Who knows?
Oui. Chittasi knows.
What is it? Yeah, upadana, that's right. So we have this nice clicker now. I feel like a professional. Look at this. Thanks for whoever donated this. I'm not sure if that person is here or on the YouTube or whatever. Don't have to bow over that all the time anymore. That's good. So, the next factor after craving in dependent origination is the upadana. And we've translated it here with two ways, fuel or taking up. And I will explain why we use two different translations for one word, yeah, which is sort of unique. You see all the other factors, they don't have two different translations, but here we did. And I will explain that. And I will explain some other things about upadana. First, I will address these six topics. Upadana, meaning taking up, and then what that means in the context of rebirth, taking rebirth, and then that upadana can also mean fuel. And then I will explain how the word upadana as fuel is used in the context of rebirth again. And when we talk about rebirth, we're talking about dependent origination. Then, if we have time, I will address a little bit about the Brahmanical background to the idea of fuel. Because the Buddha has a lot of similes on fire and fuel. And it's not explicitly stated in the suttas, but there may be some reason for this, which has to do with his cultural background. And then I'll talk a little bit about cessation of upadana, so when there's no fuel, no rebirth. I hope I have time enough to do those six topics, but we'll see. And this morning Ajahn Brahmali gave a really nice, a very practical talk I found about the two kinds of thinking and about how to relate to our desires and to our anger and cruel thoughts. And thank you for that, Ajahn Brahmali, because my biggest problem is like the sensual thoughts, and I really think like I can use that sutta by the Buddha a bit more about the two kinds of thoughts, right? And especially when it comes to sensual thoughts, sometimes you have like a choice at a moment in your life: am I going to go the sensual road, or am I going to take the road of renouncement? And we probably all recognize that to some extent. And maybe on the way back, you drive past the drive-through, and you're like, "Oh, shall I go through the drive-through, or shall?" You know, that's a simple kind of sensual desire, but we all recognize. So those are very, very practical and very applicable suttas that we've seen this morning. They're really nice. When I'm talking about this, though, I have to say it gets a little bit less practical in a sense, because when we're talking about what upadana means, it gets a little bit technical in a sense. But I don't want to have that scare you away, because I also find that having a better technical understanding of the suttas can also become practical by itself. Because if you understand the suttas better, they become more inspiring. And more inspiration has so many benefits. It will lead us to practice more. It will lead to more joy and all those kinds of good things. Yeah. We all know the feeling of inspiration from time to time. We are really inspired, sometimes not so much. I think you guys must be all really, really inspired to come to this dependent origination class every week. So you're probably very inspired. But sometimes we don't feel so much. And then it's nice to read the suttas. And sometimes you get more of an idea of what the words mean and how they're used, it Yeah, it gives me more inspiration, especially because when I analyze the suttas a bit more technically, then usually I find that things become more simple. They become more relatable. It's never that if I look at a sutta in more detail, it's never the case that it becomes more complicated to me. It always becomes a bit more simple and relatable. And I hope to give you that same kind of feeling when it comes to the word upadana. But we'll see how we go. So, those are the six topics. First one. Upadana means taking up. That's one of the meanings of upadana. It's usually translated as clinging. But for those who have been to Ajahn Brahm's dependent origination classes, for years he has been translating upadana as taking up, and he's always been hammering that, or fuel. Yeah, he also translated it as fuel, but taking up. But for some reason or the other, clinging has become the standard translation. I think that's very bad translation, though, because if you look at how the word upadana is used in context, and not just the word upadana itself, but also words that are closely related to it, basically roots from the same, we say the same, or words from the same root, we say, for example, verb forms, then you will see that you can't use clinging in those kind of contexts. For example, well, first of all, actually, if you just take the word itself and split it up and translate it very literally, you have up-a-dana. Yeah? The word up is like up in English. Yeah, this is very literal. And then the A here, that is means something like un. Or means something like the reverse. And then dana is related to the word donate. You recognize even in English, dana and donate, they sound the same, right? Both at the D and the M. So those are related. We've talked about this before, that those languages are very related. So if you would take this very literal, then you get something like up on donate. Yeah, so the opposite of donating, basically, yeah. So the opposite of giving means taking, yeah. So take it very literal, then you arrive at something like uptake or to take up for upadana. Yeah. You will also recognize adana from the precepts, adinadana, yeah. Not taking what is not given. So there you also have the taking. So if you go very literal, then you already arrive at to take up, and very old dictionaries, they already have this meaning as well. But sometimes literal is not always the best way to look at words. You have to actually look at them in the context. But in the context, we see that this works as well. Here's just some quick examples of context that use the word upadana, or closely related words. We have a seed takes up nutrition from the soil. Right, a seed sort of sucks up the nutrition from the soil, takes up. Yeah? You don't say a seed clings to the nutrition from the soil. That doesn't make any sense. Now we have abandon bad qualities and don't take them back up. That's upadana. Just as the pot turned upside down spills its water and does not take it back in. This is also very clear that the pot upside down doesn't cling to the water, right? That's not the point. The point is that it doesn't take it back. So that's another example in context that we have here. One a bit more related to dependent origination. Get rid of the aspects of existence, that's the khandhas. Don't accumulate them. Accumulating is like taking things, right? Abandon them, don't take them up. Throw them away, don't gather them. Then gather them. The gathering is like also like taking. Yeah? Gathering and accumulating, those are synonyms for taking, not for clinging. Right? Everybody agree on that to some extent? Do you see that clinging doesn't make sense in these kind of contexts? Yeah. So I spend a bit of time on that because clinging is such a common translation that I think it's worth looking into it, whether this is right or not.
What about grasping? Like grasping?
Yeah, that's Ajahn Sujata's translation is grasping. So I don't like that either. It's better than clinging. Of course, there's a difference between clinging and taking up, right? Let's say a glass of water. I cling to it. It's like I hold it and I don't give it away ever. That is something very different from a glass of water is there and I go and take it up, right? That's very different. And grasping, yeah, is sort of in between, you could say. It's like this moment. But to me, it comes down to the really taking something or picking it up. It's like, as it says here, accumulating or gathering, especially when it comes to the khandhas here. You talked about before, you could look at dependent origination as the recreation of the khandhas for in the next life. You didn't use the word recreation, but this is what this is pointing to some extent as well. What do you think of grasping, Ajahn?
I think there are certain contexts where taking up is not ideal. For example, in one place it says that nandi is the same as upadana, for example. And nandi means to delight. So basically saying that upadana is equivalent to delighting in something. Yeah. I think in that context, taking up is maybe not ideal. But there is, you know. But generally speaking, I agree with your analysis. I think sometimes, it's like all words, they're not kind of captured by a single translation often in English. You have to kind of broaden out a little bit.
Where it talks about nandi, I think it has the meaning of fuel. So this is to say that upadana can mean taking up. And why is this important, this taking up? Well, we've got here a very delightful monk explaining it a bit. This is Ajahn Ganha. Some of you might know him. He's sort of popular in our circles. And he says, your heart only knows how to take. Well, he said this in Thai, and this is the translation. It wants happiness. It is a taker that has wandered through many existences and lives already. Even being born comes down to this. Being born comes down to taking things. We have in English, we have the expression to take rebirth, right? It's this very English expression. You can't say that in Dutch, and I think in many other languages you don't say it in that way, like to take rebirth. But this taking, this aspect, that is really what I think upadana is about. Because you go out for something, you go out for more experiences. Let's say you are dying and you don't want to stop existing, right? And you go out and take up another existence. You take up the five aggregates again for a next life. And that is how the Buddha spoke about it. For example, in this sutta. What is the burden? The five aspects of existence which are taken up, the upadana khandhas, form, sensation, perception, will, and consciousness. We've mentioned these before. Yeah? And what is taking the burden? It is the craving that leads to a next life. You see here directly the link between craving and upadana, right? Craving, we said, is what comes before upadana. So we have here craving that leads to a next life. Life is bhava. This is what is taking the burden is. So when we are not enlightened and we die, and we did this many times in the past before, when we die, we don't keep still. Our mind doesn't keep still. It goes out and takes up experience again. It takes up these khandhas again. These khandhas which are taken up.
What is the
mind?
Pali for taking then? Taking the burden?
That is diyati, I think. It's not upadiyati, but diyati is almost the same word, basically. So yeah, what the Buddha is here saying is, if you have craving when you die, and then that leads to taking up, leads to the next life. And this is the problem, of course, in dependent origination, is being reborn. That is the problem. As it says in the Second Noble Truth, this is, by the way, is a short version of the Second Noble Truth here. And in the Second Noble Truth it says, what is the origin of suffering? It says, it is the craving that leads to a next life. That is the tamha ponobhavika. Yeah. Not any kind of craving is not so much the origin of suffering. It's only the craving that eventually leads us to being reborn. I think that's quite an important distinction to make in understanding the whole broader picture of dependent arising, dependent origination. Because let's say one of you has a lot of craving maybe in their life, but eventually in this lifetime they become enlightened and they make it to the end of craving. Then all craving that has happened before in your life,
it doesn't
really count.
It doesn't really count for dependent origination. I think my mic is broken. Hello?
It doesn't the craving you did before you became enlightened doesn't really count for dependent origination, because it doesn't lead to a next life. It doesn't lead to a bhava. So when we were discussing earlier, is there good craving? Well, you could maybe turn it around. Is all craving bad? Well, in a sense, yes, because it all comes from ignorance. But you could also say the worst of all craving is this kind of craving that leads to rebirth, because when you're born, then suffering is a given, which we'll discuss later when we talk about the links of birth and suffering, the last two links of dependent origination. Even if you're enlightened and you're not craving anymore because you were born, you still are suffering, and you can still get all the diseases and pain, and just to exist in itself, compared to the peace of Nibbana, is suffering. So, yeah. That's what the Buddha had to say about craving leading to taking up. So that's one aspect of upadana, is the taking up aspect. And looking at it from the point of cessation, and this is not the literal translation, but sort of summarizes what the sutta says, when enlightened beings die, they lay down this body and do not take up another. So take up is upadana again. This is clearly about rebirth here, right? They don't, enlightened beings, the arahants, they do not have craving, so they don't have this upadana, they don't have this taking up of another body. And another body, of course, means another existence, right? Another life. It's not just only a body that you take up, it means the whole of the five aggregates, really. So this is the positive side, you could say, of the upadana thing, is when you have no craving and you have no taking up, then you would have no next life. It's a simple principle, really. As I said before, when you analyze the suttas and things become more simple, I always like that. It gives me a lot of faith and inspiration in the Buddha's teaching, because all these suttas, they approach the same thing from a different angle, but they all come down to this same idea. So this, you could say, this is yet another way of explaining dependent cessation, really, the cessation sequence of dependent arising in a very short way. Maybe a little bit early to take a break, but I think it's a good point, because after this I'll talk about upadana as fuel. So if any questions, maybe we should meditate a bit first, actually. Then we do some questions. so. And why I sort of made this point about taking up versus clinging is because I feel taking up has a more active meaning. This has more, the way I understand the word anyway, has more of a meaning of going after something, right? Instead of clinging, you sort of hold on to what you already have. But I think that's what it comes down to, rebirth. We go and get a new life again every time. So any questions here? Or yeah, Eddie, please walk up to the microphone. And we, just for the tea guys, we don't have the tablet here with the questions from online, so maybe I'm not sure if there's any. Yeah, Eddie, please.
Yeah. My question is regarding craving. The next one is fuel not taking up. Okay, yeah. Can there be a management, you know? For example, like how much craving it is before you can have the fuel, you know? Maybe a little bit craving, it wouldn't lead to taking up. You see what I mean?
Yeah, maybe a little bit of bad is still good. Again, we've discussed this problem about how it depends on how you define craving and all this sorts of stuff. But in the end, when you are enlightened, then you won't crave at all. Like, yeah, you won't. Especially, you won't crave to be reborn again, right?
I know.
Yeah. So I would say even a little bit of craving is still a problem. For example, maybe you could say a non-returner, right? Somebody who's almost enlightened, for those who, those terms may be new to you. They are still a little bit of craving, you could say. Yeah? Mm. So, but they are still like top-notch people, so you could say, is that bad that they still crave? Well, no. It's hard to call those people bad, you know.
Absolutely, sure.
But, I don't know if that answers your question.
I think it's only us we know if you are following the path, you know, if you have too much craving and then something will happen, you know, do you believe that? We'll feel not well and then we correct ourselves, you see.
Yeah, the more craving you have, and especially since we're talking about rebirth here, I would say the more craving you have, the coarser your craving also will be. And coarser and the more craving you have, you're more likely to get reborn in lower realms of existence. If you have only a little bit of craving, just as I said, the non-returner, for example, they have a little bit of craving to exist in these mental realms of the of the higher jhanas, and they only have a little bit of craving, so they get reborn in a good place. But if you have a lot of craving, then it's not very likely that you'll be reborn there. So, So in the end, all the craving is that leads to taking up in that sense, and it leads to fuel. But there's different grades of taking up as well. It's not just yes or no question. Ananda, please.
Venerable, this is on a question that arose in my mind when I was reading one of the recommended suttas. I think it's 44, SN 449, Kutuhala Sahala Sutta. It is in your listing, I think. That in the last sentence, it is on the craving. In the last sentence, this is the Vacca who goes and asks the Buddha. And Buddha says that one who has died, wording is who has put the body down, who is attached, who is not reborn in any realm, the fuel is craving. If he is not born in any realm, Ajahn, is this referring to that antarabhava that you have been talking about? Or it's not directly related to this topic, but it is in the recommended list, so I thought I might.
I think Venerable Sinha, you are talking about
Venerable
Sinha? Maybe you can answer that one.
I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to, but I know
I know what you're referring to. Yeah, I know. It is saying that you have passed away in this life, but you have not yet been reborn not yet. In the next life.
Yes.
At that point, what is it that sustains you?
Exactly. Exactly.
That'll come up later.
Yeah.
Maybe I have that exact sutta. Do I?
You do.
Yeah. Oh, it's in your listing. That's how I read it. That's how I read it. It's in your listing. 44.9. It's in 44.9. Why I remember?
Oh, I know now. Yeah.
Kutuhala is one of the very classic Sinhala name as well. It's a Pali word, but it's the same meaning in Sinhala, so it stuck in me. And also on the other one, Venerable, that what you put, Ajahn Ganha's, that slide, that word taker, it may be referring to acquisitions, which is also used for sankhara sometimes, acquisitions. Taking, he says taker is not, that is accumulator sort of thing, I think Ajahn Ganha talking about there, I think.
Yeah, well, as I said, he spoke that in Thai, and we don't know exactly what he said. But I only have the translation.
Okay.
Yeah, so all that's right. What I go by.
Okay, thank you.
But thanks for knowing better the course material than I do. That's pretty cool. That's pretty amazing.
I may ask a question from the previous session, because there wasn't time before the break asking. I was just wondering how, if you could clarify, Ajahn, how the sutra on two kinds of thoughts, how were you relating it to the Vedana, Paccaya, Ganha? Is it that the two kinds of thought are in reaction to a Vedana you feel, and then it leads to a craving, or if you could just clarify how?
Yeah, well, I mean, most of those unwholesome thoughts, there are kinds of craving, the anger and anger usually comes from craving somehow, even though aversion is the immediate reaction, it often develops into anger and certainly the sensual desire has always been kind of craving. Yeah. So when we're dealing with these kind of thoughts, we're essentially dealing with craving. Yeah. So we are making sure that we have enough mindfulness on the sensation and the Vedana to enable us to react appropriately to those sensations. And not to crave too much, not to crave, whatever it is that you're craving, whether it's ill will or negative, positive craving or whatever it is. So I think it is directly related to the gradual reduction in craving. Yeah.
Responding to the sensation without giving rise to those kinds of thoughts.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sounds like it. Are you equating like aversion or that sense of, the wrong thought of having ill will? That would sort of equal vipavatanha, or am I oversimplifying?
I think very often ill will is a kind of craving as well. It's a craving to get rid of, a craving to correct, a craving to sort out, a craving. It kind of includes aversion, includes all of those things. But it's more than that. It's also a wanting to do something which has a negative impact on the other person. What exactly were you asking? Yeah.
I was wondering if that you could call that a kind of vipassana craving, not a craving to like not exist, but a craving not to exist in the sense of having that particular situation. Whatever.
You can call it that, but that's not really how it's used in the sutta. I know it kind of colloquially it's often used like that, but I don't think it's used like that in the sutta. Sutta really means vibhava means the opposite of existence, means non-existence. So you want to annihilate not just the thought, that is using it in a metaphorical sense if you use it in that way. Yeah. But it doesn't really have a metaphorical sense, it really means you want to annihilate yourself. Yeah, you want to commit suicide. That's what it means, really. Yeah. And then unfortunately, it doesn't work. Yeah, you commit suicide and you kind of re-arise again. So that's why it's vipava tanha. It actually leads to rebirth because you're trying to create something in the future, and that very act of trying to create something in the future actually gives rise to rebirth. So it's different from, I would just call it ill will or aversion in that case, rather than vipavatanha. I would say that the aversion is part of sensual desire. Yeah, either you don't like the sensual object or you like it. Yeah? Two sides of the same thing. Yeah.
Does craving for non-existence be craving for nibbana?
If you have a misunderstanding of nibbana, then it could be. Because vibhava tanha really implies So this is the craving for annihilation or the craving for non-existence. It implies that you still have a sense of a self or a being or a somebody who you want to have to cease, right? Somebody who you want to stop. But Nibbana is not somebody stopping, not a self stopping. It is just a process that comes to an end without any core inside of it. So therefore you can't call that annihilation, because annihilation means something that really exists and you make that go away. But Nibbana means it literally means going out like a flame goes out, but a flame has no essence to it. So but from a perspective of self, the two seem very similar. Yeah. So from a perspective of self, if you don't understand non-self yet, then Nibbana, you can't avoid it. It always will seem like annihilation in a sense. You still have a sense of self. And Nibbana will always feel like I am getting destroyed or annihilated or whatever. And the Sutta's talking about that as well. Like, oh no, I will stop existing. Oh no, I will cease to be. That's what people say after they hear the Buddha speak. Yeah. So these are people who haven't really understood yet on a deeper level that there's no I or self inside that will cease to be. And I'll talk about this simile of the fuel a bit more, or the fire a bit more later. Hope that makes some sense. I think.
Yeah, I just maybe add that you can experience some of that already in meditation. Yeah, sometimes when the meditation goes really well and the thinking is starting to die down and you feel like you are giving up large parts of yourself, the more peaceful you are, the less of you is basically there. Yeah, the less of you is actually existing. Yeah? And there comes a point when you start to get fearful because you have to give up things that are really deep, you identify in a very deep sense with. Yeah? And when you have to give up things that you identify with in a deep way, it actually can give rise to fear in meditation. But if you carry on and you go through that, you get even more happiness afterwards, because you're giving up things that are not really you, but feel like they are you. So if you kind of extrapolate on that and take it to its kind of, you know, as far as it can go, then you can start to understand why giving up everything actually is the highest happiness.
Yeah. Yeah, so if we translate Bhavatana as craving for non-existence, I like to translate it as craving for annihilation, because it implies more this destruction of a something which doesn't exist. But yeah. Hope that answers your question to some extent. All right. So no questions from online, it seems. Yeah, this one sort of we answered already, I would say, or unless you want to add something.
Maybe just add very quickly that there's a question from online. Could the power of reflection be equal to the second factor of awakening? So the second factor of enlightenment or awakening is called the Dhammavicchaya Sambojanga, which is the awakening factor of investigation of principles or investigation of mental qualities or different ways of translation. So is it equal to that? I wouldn't say it's equal to that, because when it comes to the awakening factors, what you're already doing meditation practice, yeah, is the investigation that goes together with meditation. But the power reflection begins a long time before that. It begins when you are already deciding just to live well, to live skillfully, yeah, because you have a good reason for that. And then you keep on investigating and reflecting on the nature of the world, and then you change the way you think about the world. There's all of that. But that is not yet meditation necessarily. It goes way outside of meditation. But the bhujangas are largely related to meditation practice.
Right. One other question popped up while you were speaking. Are there different forms of craving, such as craving to satisfy basic needs, such as hunger, thirst, affection, etc.? I would say there are different kinds of craving. Yeah, not all craving is the same. The Buddha defined craving in a more formal way as craving for the six different senses. So it said there are six categories of craving, like craving for sights, for sounds, for tastes, for touches, for smells, and for mental phenomena, like maybe mental happiness or something. So those are different kind of craving. But to satisfy basic needs, such as hunger, thirst, etc., I'm not sure. I don't think that always comes down to craving. Because even if you're enlightened, you will still set your basic needs, and it doesn't come down to craving. So I would. Yeah. Do you want to do one question?
Okay, Ken. Okay, last one. As part of being a family member, I will have to cling to cravings of family members deliberately for my survival. How to deal with this? Yes, there is always going to be some craving in regard to your family members, yeah? And it's okay. Don't worry about it, because these are very kind of core things. It is not I don't think it's going to be a big hindrance on the path. Remember, instead of often people focus too much on overcoming attachments and overcoming craving, but really the core issue should be, am I practicing the path in the correct way? And if you are practicing the path in a correct way, these cravings and attachments, they will die down by themselves. This is almost automatic as you practice the path. So instead of worrying about the craving towards your family members, worry instead about how you treat your family members. Yeah, treat them well. Treat them with kindness. Treat them with respect and love and compassion and all of these kind of things. And as you do that, you will develop the path. And then actually the craving will go down. The attachment will go down. You become more independent as a person. And that doesn't mean you become more cold or you care less about them or whatever. I always like to say it means the opposite, because the less vested interest that you have, the more clearly you see what is required. If you want your children to do well at school so it glorifies your family, this is usually what happens. Yeah, my children get A's so I can tell the neighbors. Otherwise, the neighbors are going to look down upon us if you don't get straight A's. So get A's, yeah? And very often we reflect our own value in what our children do. Yeah, that's why we feel, that's one of the reasons we feel upset if they only get B plus. B plus is not good enough. Yeah, we want A or A minus. It's a very common thing around the world if you look at, you know, how people deal with the children. The children becomes the extension of the parents' ego. Yeah, the extension of your ego is your children. So instead of that, yeah, and I'm sure many of you already understand this, we love our children unconditionally, regardless of what they do. That is the right approach to children. Even if they fail at school, if they have a good heart, what really matters in life? Is it having a good heart? Or is it kind of getting straight A's and being a crook or whatever? You know, we look at things that really matter, really actually have to do with happiness and deep inner contentment and these kind of things. And then you are dealing with your family in the right way. So work on those areas. And as you work on those areas, the cravings and these other problems, they will actually fade away by themselves. And they won't become so much of a problem anymore. Sometimes we focus on the wrong things on the path, and that can lead to more problems than solutions. You want to do the next one? I don't know.
Yeah. Ajahn, are we dealing with craving when we think of the fourth hindrance, restlessness of the mind? Well, it says Ajahn, so it should be for you.
You are Ajahn is teacher, yeah? So you're teacher.
Okay. Yeah, well, restlessness is a kind of craving. I would say yes, because restlessness is often desire to be somewhere else than where we are currently. The opposite of restlessness is contentment, peace, happiness, to be just happy whatever happens, right? If we're not happy with what is happening in our meditation, then we often desire to be somewhere else. And this desire, you could say, yeah, it's like craving. And this craving is the restlessness. That's one way of looking at it. There's also the hindrance, the first hindrance of sense desire, yeah, and this is clearly more directly related to craving, sense desire, the craving for sense experiences. This, by the way, can be a very subtle kind of desire to experience anything, through the five senses. When the five senses start to disappear, Ajahn said, you can have fear when things start disappearing. You also can have a desire when things start disappearing to experience something through the five senses, because this, you're so used to that. And when they start disappearing, that comes up as a desire. And these five hindrances, they are not like, life doesn't work in five boxes. Yeah, your meditation is not limited to five experiences. So these five hindrances are just five ways of looking at your meditation. And yeah, you could say restlessness and craving. You could say they're similar or related anyway.
One more.
I think I'll move on because the questions keep rolling in as we go, but I will never get to say what I prepared. I will never get to Sanyutta 44.9, huh? So that will be a problem. So people online will hopefully answer your questions later, but sorry if we don't have the time. So I talked before about upadana meaning taking up, and I said in the introduction, it can also mean fuel, and I think this is what Ajahn Brahm has been using in his dependent origination classes, I think. Is that right? Has he been using fuel? Upadana? I think so, yeah. Thomas is nodding. Yeah. He's always in the front, so he's the best students in the front. So, upadana can also mean fuel. And how can it be that the word, one word, upadana, can mean two such seemingly different things? Taking up and fuel, they seem very unrelated. And then first of all, we have to know that certain words can function both as a verb as a noun. So a verb, for those who don't know, is like an action word, and a noun is like a thing word. So, for example, take the word to talk. So I'm talking now, that is a verb. But there's also a talk. Yeah, you can give the talk, and then it's a noun. And you could also take a verb like to fly. But there's also a thing like the fly, yeah? The little creature that we have lots of in Bodhinyana right now. There's like hundreds of them. It's always this time of the year. So certain words, although they look the same, talk, here, talk as a verb and talk as a noun, they look the same, but they mean something different. And kind of fly as a verb means something very different from fly as a noun. And it's the same with upadana. There's both, it can have a verbal kind of meaning, which is this taking up that I talked about before. And it also can have a noun meaning. And so the verb meaning here for upadana is to take up, but the noun meaning is fuel. And this seems a little bit awkward from an English perspective, but from the Pali perspective, this makes total sense. But you could think of it as the fuel, as the thing that is taken up, or the thing that is used up, in a sense. So a fuel in Pali language, in English again it doesn't make much sense, but in Pali language a fire takes up fuel. In English we would say it uses up fuel. And that's why you have upadana meaning both to take up and the fuel. I hope that makes some sense. If you want to know more detail, then you have to come to Pali classes in the Bodhinyana Monastery, like Venerable is. So that is how upadana can also mean fuel. And now, how about fuel in the context of dependent arising, dependent originations? That will be fuel for rebirth. See, a fire burning, and of course below here is the fuel. And that's what I mean by fuel in this context. A fire uses fuel to burn. Here's the Buddha speaking. Imagine a heap of wood that's on fire. From time to time, you throw dry grass, cow dung, or wood onto it. With that fuel, that upadana, that food, the fire will burn for a long time. So here the Buddha is giving clearly some sort of simile, right? What is this simile for? Like, it's for dependent origination, as you'll see. Likewise, when you focus on the attractiveness of things, craving increases. Now, when you look only at the beautiful side of things, craving increases when you only look at how nice things are, you start to crave it more. Dependent on craving, there is fuel. Dependent on fuel, there is life. Dependent on craving, there is fuel. Well, here, of course, the Buddha is not talking about this physical kind of fuel that a fire uses, right? He's talking about fuel in a more, much more abstract sense. It's like the fuel for a next life. What fuels us into another existence? This is the craving. The craving is the fuel that drives us on. It's the like you say the energy. Maybe that's a more modern word for fuel. Craving is like the energy that moves us on from one life to the next. The Buddha is using upadana fuel in a really like a visual way. Right? It's like if we don't stop craving, it's like we keep a fire burning all the time. That's what he's saying here. With that fuel, the fire will burn for a long time. Like a long time, clearly referring to samsara. Samsara is always called a long time. We go through samsara forever and ever. Why? Because we keep fueling our existence. We keep throwing fuel on into the fire of samsara, you could say. That makes sense? Yeah. So, if we look at the sequence of dependent origination, we could say craving leads to fuel, or craving is fuel, you could say, and that leads to a next life. Yeah. Craving is the fuel that drives us on. And as I said before, especially this kind of craving that leads to rebirth, that is the craving that is the fuel for our next life. Not all kinds of craving, but especially this craving that happens around the time when you pass away. That will be fuel to drive you on again. And some other interesting point to about this sutta is that the word heap here is kanda. Right? So I think the Buddha uses this as another simile, right? He's saying the khandhas, the five aggregates, yeah, they are on fire. So in just a little text like this, you have so many different references, like this long time to samsara, the khandha to the aggregates, and then we have the fuel, right? That is like the fuel independent origination. Maybe even the different types of fuel, maybe he even had some reasons for that, like dry grass, cow dung, and wood, maybe. But I don't know what that would be, but maybe the three kinds of craving or something could be the three kinds of fuel. But it's not clear from the suttas if that is so. So, a big pile of fuel we are making, in a sense, when we crave. Yeah? And this fuel drives on the rebirth. This energy keeps us going. And when I was preparing this slide, I thought of this tradition that they have in the Netherlands around New Year's, which is coming up again. And then they have certain cities, they have a fight who can build the biggest pile of wood, basically. And look at this. You see a little guy standing on the top. Oh, this point is not working. Is it working? Little guy standing here on the top. And then there's a crane here, putting all the pallets on top of these pallets. And then they set it on fire at New Year's Eve. And the fire department is always very unhappy about this, of course. I just thought it was really funny. It's just so big. So please, if you are going to build this pile of fuel for samsara, don't build such a big one. Build just a small one, or better, build none at all, right? You not only make the fire department happy, you also make yourself happy, because that's when you become enlightened. So this is another sutta using the fuel, upadana this simile. Yeah? Ananda, you know all about this sutta. This is the Buddha speaking here. Vaccha, I say rebirth happens for one with fuel, not for one without fuel. Just as a fire burns when it has fuel, not when it has no fuel, so I say rebirth happens for one with fuel, not for one without fuel. The Buddha is here referring back to this craving being the fuel, right? So rebirth happens not without a reason. It doesn't just happen out of nowhere. It happens because we provide the impetus, we provide the Buddha calls it fuel for it by craving. So that's what the Buddha is saying. It doesn't just happen out of nowhere. It happens because we do it. We create the rebirth. And then Vaccha asks, Sir Gautama, that's the Buddha, when a fire is carried by the wind and it travels a certain distance, what would you say is its fuel then? We in Australia here are very, very familiar, unfortunately, with this kind of principle, right? When there's the forest fires, they travel for miles through the air, right? You have one of these cinders and they just light the fire somewhere else. This is what Vaccha is asking about. He's actually taking this question deeper later. Because, of course, he's not interested about the physics of forest fires. He's interested about rebirth, as we'll see. But the Buddha answers. He knows where Vaccha is going. He says, when a fire is carried by the wind and it travels a certain distance, I say the wind is its fuel, quote unquote, then, because at that time the wind is what fuels it. He says the wind is then upadana. Is of course, not literally the fuel from a physical point of view, but the Buddha calls the wind the fuel because, we'll see, wind is very similar to craving. When somebody abandoned their body, Vaccha asked, this is an actual question that he was going to, abandoned their body and is not yet reborn in another body, what would you say is their fuel then, their upadana then? So this is somebody who is obviously who's passed away, but they are not yet reborn, but they are in what we say, you could say, sort of like an in-between state, sort of like almost like a ghost, basically, between lives. They're traveling from one life to the next. Obviously, those are not enlightened. Yeah? Okay, because when you're enlightened and you pass away, then you don't go hanging around anymore. But these people, they still hang around. And what is their fuel then? What drives them on to be reborn? The Buddha's answer: when somebody abandoned their body and is not yet reborn in another body, I say craving is their fuel then, because at that time craving is what fuels it. So craving is the fuel for a rebirth. The same principle as what I talked about before in the previous sutta. So this is another example of how suttas, they seem different at the surface, but in the end they say the same thing, right? So here the Buddha, craving. Craving is sort of like the wind which pushes us forward. That's how I would see that.
Yeah. This is the sutta that Ananda was talking about before. Yeah.
Yep.
This is the one you can see here. You know, you have died, but you haven't been reborn yet. And you are fueled by craving, so that is a very clear sign that there is something happening between death and rebirth. This, I think, maybe number one exhibition in the sutta. Mm-hmm. Number one exhibit, yeah.
So, that is what it's called.
That's what it's called in the commentaries, I think, Antara Baba, yeah. Yeah, I refer to this one, yeah. But there are many, lots of little evidences like that. But this is kind of probably the strongest one, yeah.
So this is, because ghost and fate, that is a different realm. So you can't say it's a ghost or anything. They are, because Buddha says here, not you go on with anyone in realm.
Yeah.
So it must be something in between.
This is the one.
Yeah, so just to clarify for people who don't know what's going on, in the Theravada tradition, some people have traditionally held the idea that once you die, you're reborn immediately in another body somewhere else in the next moment. That's sort the ancient idea, and but there's many suttas which imply the more natural way of thinking about things, that you die and then you travel to another body, like not instantly, but you take a while. So, yeah, to me it doesn't make sense. You would die and suddenly I get reborn in the next moment somewhere. Yeah, you exist a little bit in between. Does that answer your question?
I just want to clarify that this is the answer about. In fact, what came to my mind was that Ajahn Brahm. Ajahn Brahm relates the story that when someone's mother died in India, appeared here in your mother, in his bedroom. I think because that may not be a ghost.
Well, that's the thing. It may not be possible to classify it exactly, but it would be something like a ghost. Yeah, something similar. Yeah. But I think once you are a ghost, then you are locked into a kind of miserable existence. At this point, you may not be locked into any kind of misery yet.
Because ghosts are for a long time.
Depending on the karma, I suppose. But
All right. I think the people on the YouTube didn't really get that because we didn't use the microphone. So sorry for that. But we're moving on now. So. Just to point out that here, craving is the fuel, right? We've seen in dependent origination the sequence, craving and then upadana. And we often say, dependent on craving, there is upadana. So dependent on craving, there is fuel. And I've talked before, but I don't like to think of that as causal things, because then you would think in terms of craving causes fuel, right? But here, Buddha is saying craving is the fuel. So don't think of terms of the dependent origination always as causal or sequential. Sometimes things are just synonyms for one another. Like here, craving and upadana, they are like synonyms, right? So they depend on another in another way, not causal. So I hope that makes sense. Yeah. Craving is the fuel. So, anybody remember this picture that I spent much time on drawing? I spent so much sweat and tears went into this, I thought I'd show you again. Yeah. And Ajahn Brahmali said my seed looked more like a potato. I remember that, yeah.
I apologize.
Artistic
freedom. Yeah,
no, I'm kidding. Anyway, remember this picture? So, here we were talking about craving being the moisture and the field being like karma. That was last week, I think. And the Buddha uses very similar sutta to the ones we've seen before, using fuel, not just for fuel for a fire, but fuel for plants to grow. Imagine a sapling. From time to time, you give it fresh soil, like that would be the karma, and you give it water, that would be like craving. With that fuel, that food, that sapling will develop, sprout, and grow. We see these terms, develop, sprout, and grow, again and again in dependent origination, because the Buddha is using this seed simile all the time. Yeah, develop, sprout, and grow, when it refers to a seed, that makes sense, but the Buddha also uses it to refer like to the khandhas in a more like in the sense of a simile, right? The khandhas sprout in the next life. Yeah. They sprout like a seed, you could say. And then they grow. I'll see what that means. Likewise, when you focus on the attractiveness of things, craving increases. Depending on craving, there is fuel. Depending on fuel, there is life, there's bhava, etc. So, very similar, but the fuel is here is just another kind of fuel, right? Not the fuel for a fire, but fuel for growing a seed. It's very much related to those texts that I spoke about the other week. So that's just some examples of suttas where upadana is used as fuel, and there's many more. And I think this imagery gets often doesn't get given enough attention, because the Buddha uses imagery all the time throughout the suttas. When you read the suttas, you will know he compares people to horses and all sorts of just similes to get us to look at things in a different way. But for some reason, when people start talking about dependent origination, they very often leave out all the similes and all the parables, and they become very technical, I find anyway. So I like to get back to these kind of similes, because to me they make a lot of sense, and they're very beautiful examples, because similes also, we can all use them in our own little private ways that make sense to us. Yeah. So that's upadana as fuel. And shall we take a little break? What do we think, Ajahn?
Sure.
I think we shall.
Yep.
anybody has any questions about what we've just been talking about?
I'm just wondering how willed acts create karma, and then how the craving, the tanha, creates upadana, and how the upadana and the karma, what relationship there is between the two. I'm a bit confused from the fuel and then the karmic results.
Good question. I'm not sure how to approach an answer. First of all, karma and craving, they're not the same thing, right? And you could look at fuel as the energy that drives us forward into another rebirth. So craving is what drives us forward. And then karma is more like giving us a direction, well, to good lives or bad lives. That's how I always have looked at it. So karma is not so much the fuel by itself. You always need craving for there to be rebirth. Because karma implies craving, but they're not the same. So therefore, I wouldn't call karma fuel. I'm not making sense, I don't think. Because I don't really get what you are asking, to be honest. Yeah, sure.
I'll give it a shot, see what happens. The thing is that when you take something up, at that point there is an intention. So that very act of taking up is actually karma. So at that point you're making karma. So for example, if you're just a simple taking up, like taking up, if you're greedy, you grasp something, this is mine, at that point you're making karma. Or you are taking up an act of ill will. Yeah, that's also kind of taking up, perhaps, in a broader sense. You're making karma. And the act of taking up often leads to attachment. Yeah, the things that you take up in the world lead to attachments. So, for example, you take up living in a house, you take up being a monastic, or you take up certain sensual pleasures. And once you take those up, then you tend to make karma in that sphere. Yeah, because you are enjoying sensuality, sensual objects, so your intention tends to be go towards those sensual objects that you've taken up. You sit in your meditation because you're taken up living in a house. You think about the house. Oh no, there's a fire in the neighborhood. What if my house burns down? What if the thief comes? Yeah, and you are attached to that, and that is a kind of karma that you're making through that attachment. So the things that you take up tend to direct your mind in a certain way, and you tend to make karma around that. Whether that karma is good or bad will depend on the circumstances. Yeah, if the thief comes and you get really angry with the thief, you thief, get out of here, maybe you kill the thief, you make bad karma. Yeah, but if you do good acts out of attachment, so then you're obviously making good karma. But they will tend to give the framework for the kind of karma that you make, the things that you take up. You have the scope of attachments, so that gives a framework for the karma that you're making here. Something like that, yeah.
I think karma more closer to fuel because it is a build up of craving. So karma is closer to fuel, isn't it?
Karma is closer to fuel?
Yeah, because build up of craving creates fuel, and karma is something similar.
Yeah, it is. There is connections, of course, between craving and karma. And this is the thing about using words to describe things in our mind. Sometimes we think too much in terms of boxes, or this is craving, this is karma, but they overlap, of course, to some extent as well. And Ajahn Brahmani gave a good example of that. So,
Yeah, please. All these craving, fuel, it enters us through our six sense doors. That is body, speech, and mind. He says something like, if his mind is less, like when you're actually engaging it, then it's more, more karma. You see what I mean?
No, to be honest, can you rephrase it? Sorry. I'm very bad at getting questions because.
Sorry, my English student. You know, all this like craving, all these feelings, it enters us through our earlier link, through the six sense doors. That is body, speech, and mind, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I would say craving is all in the mind. The body doesn't really. Not the kind of craving that leads to
I was thinking like the body is actually engaging in it. You know. The mind is just the thinking. You know, you're not engaging yet. You know. Body, speech, and mind.
Look at it in terms of karma again. And karma is defined by the Buddha as intentions, right? And intentions, they're all what we have in our mind. And what we do with the body, if we accidentally step on an insect or something, then to the Buddha that didn't count as bad karma. It's all about what we do in the mind. That determines what karma is.
Yeah, but... Say you're just thinking, you know, or you're doing the act, you're killing someone, or you're just thinking to kill, you know, all these things, or just saying, you know. You know, the intensity of the karma. Sorry, I was just came to my mind, I was just saying.
Yeah.
You didn't get?
Do you?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is that there's more, you're making more karma if you act it out than just thinking about it.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, and that's true, that's absolutely true. The more action you put into it, because you need more intention to actually act it out. So that would be worse karma, absolutely. Enormous difference. If you just think about it, it's not so, doesn't matter
not
all
so
that
good.
Much.
Yeah.
But if you act it out, it's really bad. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yeah.
If craving is fuel, and then upadana is also fuel, then why is it necessary to have both of them in the links?
Yeah, that's a good question. Why is it necessary? Well, why is any of the links necessary, you could ask. You could say, avidya leads to suffering. You could say that. Right? And it would be true.
Is there any significance that the Buddha tried to show us by having them both there?
I think he is... specifically implying this simile here to make things a bit more alive. And also the taking up aspect of it is also craving and taking up are slightly different. So maybe that's another reason why upadana is there. But if you look at the Noble Truth, then it just says craving is the origin of suffering, right? So that sort of skips upadana in that sense. And it skips some of the other factors as well, like bhava. And you could say, why do we include those in dependent origination? Yeah, why? Because dependent origination is trying to explain things in more, using more ways of approaching the same underlying idea that craving leads to rebirth. And upadana is there not for any I don't think for any specific reason or this is why it's there. It's just that the Buddha chose to put it there, and maybe we don't know exactly why, but yeah.
So in the first Noble Truth you would have the panchapanna, you know, the five grasping aggregates, however you translate it. So you actually use the word upadana. And the second Noble Truth, you actually use the word craving of tanha. So it seems like there may be some difference there, even within the four Noble Truths itself. And then repeat it in the 12 links in the dependent origination. So maybe there's something more than just... So you think they're just equal, totally?
Yeah, well, this is the thing with the double meaning of upadana. Sometimes it means taking up, and sometimes it means fuel. And in the First Noble Truth, when it talks about upadana khandhas, it's very unclear which of those two meanings actually is. Maybe it's both are implied, in a sense. But when we look at texts like this, like the previous one, craving is the fuel, right? That's clearly saying the two are the same, but when you would use taking up for upadana, that maybe you wouldn't say craving is taking up. You wouldn't say that because those are slightly different. So you have to, per context, you have to decide, does it mean fuel or does it mean taking up? And when it means fuel, you could say craving is fuel. When it means taking up, you don't say craving is taking up because those are still a little bit different, craving and taking up. Yeah, Ananda.
Just a quick technicality of that word fuel being used for upadana. Chattaro ahara, I think the presently instead of nutriments, I have seen mostly fuel is being used for four types of food, ahara. So wouldn't this clash, Venerable, when we use the... what shall I say, accepted, translated word, fuel for ahara.
Ah, look at this.
That's right, but that's a different context. But four types of ahara, that is kabalikara ahara, passa, manosanchetana and vijnana, that is gross or subtle food, those four, commonly is used as fuel. Am I right?
Instead of nutriments? A common translation would be nutriments.
But now I think instead of nutriments...
Yeah, Ajahn Sujato uses fuel for that.
I think that's rather than nutriments. It's, nutriments look like a type of fertilizer. So
yeah,
I think fuel...
The two are really like synonyms. You see here, with that fuel, that upadana, that food...
I know, but there would be some time when you... there could be a clash... Upadana and ahara. So anyway, I just thought I would ask that question. So
yeah, that's on the level of translation, though, if that can clash. But
yes.
In Pali, they don't really. Yeah.
But in that previous one, that question that Venerable Prasad asked, I think that fire there is Buddha is referring to that watcher's actual fire, isn't it? He is referring to the wind carrying the actual fire.
Yeah.
It's not the metaphorical, it's the literal fire. So he says, in this case, the craving is the fire. Fire like in that actual real fire. He's not equating craving to upadana there. I don't think so.
Well, yes, though, because it says craving is fuel. So craving is upadana.
Is that the Pali word there in that?
Yeah, craving is here, there pure, is upadana.
Okay.
And there's actually, as I said here, see also these suttas and others where it equates things like tanha and nandi and some other words. It says, is upadana, it equates them to upadana. So that's why I think it means there is fuel.
Okay, thank you, sadhu.
All right. Thanks, Ananda. So, what time do we stop usually? Was it
2:30?
2:30.
You want to go on with you want to do the next one or next subject? Or you
don't. Yeah. Know. Well, if I go on, then it'll sort of be very unnatural.
Okay.
So,
okay.
Maybe we'll do some questions from online then. Okay. And then we'll after the break we'll hopefully speak things up a bit. Why does it take a while to be reborn after dying?
If not the first one. The first one is the.
Oh. There's a line between. Okay. How is Sankara different in the three characteristics in the 12 Nidanas and the 5 Khandas? Thank you. Well, you're welcome. Next question. No. Well, Ajahn Brahmali, you addressed that before, right? With passive and active Sankara. Yeah. So in the three characteristics, it's like the passive Nidanas, which Ajahn Brahmali has explained before, and in the 12 Nidanas and the 5 Khandas, it's more like active. There's a very brief answer, but if that doesn't make sense, then listen to Ajahn Brahmali's talk. So, why does it take a while to be reborn after dying? Does the soul wait for the correct karma to be reborn, or wait for the right time? When the fuel is strong enough to be reborn? It's a very deep question, and I don't have the whole answer to that. But One reason I could imagine that it takes a while to be reborn after dying is because the conditions may not be right for your rebirth. It's very common that people who die, they get reborn very close to where they died, if they get reborn as a human, and often in the same family as well. So maybe an uncle passes away and he gets reborn as a nephew, or grandpa gets reborn as a dog. Yeah, a dog in the family. And of course, if you, it makes some sense, you know, right? You live in that family for your whole life, so that's where all your inclinations are, and that's where all your attachments are. There was a question before about attachment to family, and then it makes sense. And if you pass away, that you will incline to stick around that family. And of course, when you die and you really crave to reborn in that family, then it doesn't happen straight away, you know, because you know, there is nobody pregnant in that family, for example. Then it would be very hard to force somebody to be reborn. So this is an example of maybe the conditions are not right for you to be reborn where you want to be reborn. So therefore, maybe you have to wait for a little bit. There's this professor called Ian Stevenson, and he does research into people that remember their past lives. And it's very interesting. There's also some people who remember the time before they were born, after they died, and before they were born again. Like I said, I was just hanging around this village or something, they say. That's what they remember. Those memories are usually not very clear, it seems, but they remember just hanging around and then later only getting reborn. So I would say only when the conditions are right. And that is one way why it could take a while, and there may be many other reasons, but I would just be speculating, really, not coming so much from my experience. So.
Yeah. Now, I also think it's not the case that it always takes time.
Yeah.
It depends on what kind of karma you have. If you have very strong karma, for example, you're going to be reborn in the Devaloka or something like that, or very high realm, like a jhana realm. And usually what would happen is that you enter the jhana as you're dying, and then bang, jhana realm, Brahma. Yeah. Or if you have very, very bad karma, you kind of get dragged down to hell straight away. Yeah? There's no sort of get out of jail for free card. They just go bang, straight into hell because you've been a bad person. So it depends on the strength of the karma. And if the karma is not kind of, maybe karma isn't very clear cut. Maybe it's kind of the idea is that it has to kind of work itself out and get clarity about where it really needs to go. So it needs a kind of time to accumulate. You need to kind of recall your life and judge yourself in one way or another, and then you go accordingly. But one of the, I think, things about the Dhamma, one of the things that you see about the Buddha is that we don't really ask the question why things happen. Yeah, the Buddha doesn't answer the question why is there suffering. That's kind of irrelevant. If you start asking all these why questions, there is no end to them. Yeah, we don't really know why there's suffering, why there's anything. But that's not really the point. It's like that famous simile in the suttas about if you get shot with a poisoned arrow, yeah, you start, no, don't take out the poisoned arrow. Yeah, first of all, I need to know who the shooter was, yeah? Then I need to know who made the arrow. What kind of wood is the arrow, yeah? Where was it made? Was the person of this caste or that caste? No, please leave the arrow in until I know all of these things. And of course, in the meantime, you're dead, yeah? So that's kind of stupid. So all these why questions, they actually miss the point. The point is there is a problem. That problem has a solution. Get on with it. Yeah. Otherwise, you're gonna die before you get an answer, and then it's going to be too late. And I think the same thing here is the question is really, is there such a thing as an intermediate state? Okay, if there is, then we take that into account in how we look at the world. But exactly why that is the case is not really, I think, it is not a very fruitful question to ask, in my opinion. Although, perhaps in this case it is. I don't know, but usually the why question are not the best ones, it seems. Anyway, there you are.
Why are those questions so bad?
Okay.
Come. When you leave the body, you don't go anywhere. You're just not perceivable to someone else with a physical body who's using the senses, right? It's not like all of a sudden you drop the body and then move, it's a subtle vibration, right? Because you're vibrating at a particular rate. You're not vibrating, then you're not vibrating enough within the range of the body. So then you no longer sustain the body, right? But you don't actually go anywhere, do you? It's a matter of subtle energies.
Yeah, I think it all depends on what kind of rebirth you are inclined towards and what kind of life you've been living. But in general, if a human being gets reborn as a human being, and I would agree about this, that they sort of leave the body, not instantly go somewhere else, they just sort of leave it very gradually. I would agree.
Yeah.
But as Ajahn said, you could instantly be reborn as a deva, then you would instantly be somewhere else. That might happen as well. So it all depends on what kind of energy you're talking about.
Okay, should we ask the last one? Is that okay?
Yeah,
you
can
be in charge of the session. So I'm just going to ask you for permission.
I will read it out, and you can answer it if you want. The in-between stage, as I understood from late Bhante Dhammavudo, is called the Gandhava. Whether the Gandhava gets to choose the parents, if one has enough credits to gain the human rebirth. So the question is, does the Gandhava, or do you, get to choose your parents if you get reborn as a human? What do you think, Ajahn?
What I think? Yeah. do you get to choose your parents? You know, usually what happens is that we tend, like Venerable Sunda said before, we tend to get reborn with the same kind of people, yeah? So if you have dog karma, you get reborn as a dog in that family, yeah? So that's where you have to be careful. And the reason for that is because of our attachments. So when you are attached, then you tend to move towards certain people. It's just the same in this life, yeah? Because you are attached to somebody, you tend to hang out with the people that you are attached to. You tend to hang out with your family members or your good friends or whatever. In the same way as you hang out with the people you are attached to in this life, in the same way you tend to do that as the rebirth process happens. But there it's more automatic because the mind kind of drives this the process instead of it, you know, having to move physically or whatever. So we tend to get reborn where we have attachments. So is that a choice? Not necessarily, yeah? You may have some kind of ideal in your mind that, oh, I would really want to get reborn there, I want to have these people as your parents. But deep inside, there may be an attachment that drives you in a different direction from what you want, from a higher level. So it is really that, I would say, it is generally the deep attachment inside of us. The things that often you may not even be clear about, that you are attached. That is what tends to drive you onto the into the next life. So it can be very hard to know where you're going to get reborn. It is not going to be some kind of superficial choice, but some deeper rooted thing that will tend to drive this particular process. So you have to really be kind of look inside of yourself. Yeah? What are your deepest desires? What are your deepest attachments? And that will maybe give you some guideline on where you are heading in the future.
I agree with that. There's also an interesting sutta which I was thinking of bringing up earlier, but I didn't, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya somewhere. It's called the Sankara Upapatti Sutta, and it means rebirth according to sankaras, or Ajahn Sujata translates rebirth according to choice, I think. Intentions? Okay, according to intention. And the sutta goes something like this. If you have the right ethical behavior and the right kind of wisdom, you can sort of make a choice where you get reborn. It's like, oh, I want to really be reborn in this family of rich Brahmins, or the Brahmins in the time of the Buddha, or this family of rich merchants or whatever. And if you really make that intention, that sankara, very clear, and you repeat it a lot in your life, and the Buddha says you can actually influence your rebirth in that direction, and it isn't just limited to human realms. It goes on to higher realms as well, the deva realms. Oh, I really want to reborn as a high, deity. If you have that intention and you repeat it a lot, and you live your life appropriately and accordingly, this is the important thing. Then you, according to the Buddha, you can actually direct your rebirth there. But I think the point is, you have to repeat that intention a lot, I think. And then it becomes your inclination. It's not like I'm contradicting what Ajahn Brahmani said. It comes down to the same thing. If you often have the intention to get reborn with a certain family, then that becomes your inclination. And that inclination is what would then be the thing that drives your rebirth. It's an interesting sutta. I don't know the number, but that person... Sorry? 120. Well, we have...
Sankaripapatta Sutta? 120.
Yeah, 120. That's correct. See, so person who asked this question, maybe read that sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 120.
Yeah.
And that will be a very nice sutta for you to read. So, I shall have a little break, and then after the break I will treat more about the Brahmin background to Upadana and cessation of Upadana, and then Ajahn Brahmani has some more things to say also about the next factor.